Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 4th, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing the federal policy, or proposed policy on school discipline. I think we'll also be talking about the larger, broader issue of disparate impact analysis. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome to our call today two experts on our topic. We're going to hear first from Mr. Roger Clegg. He is President and General Counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity. He'll be making some very brief remarks. Then we'll hear from Hans Bader. Mr. Hans Bader is Senior Attorney and Counsel for Special Projects at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And rather than the longer opening remarks from each, it's going to be more of a conversation. But as I said, we'll begin with Mr. Clegg. And Roger, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much, Dean. I really appreciate the Federalist Society giving me this opportunity, and I'm delighted to be here with Hans Bader, of whom I'm a great admirer. I want to do a couple of things in this introduction. One is to note that this topic, as Dean says, of disparate impact, and particularly the abuse of the disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement, is unfortunately a recurrent one in the Obama administration. And actually, at the annual convention this past fall, a panel was devoted to this topic. So those in the audience who are interested in more discussion of this issue may want to listen to that panel, which is on YouTube somewhere. What I'm going to do in this teleforum is try to have this be a conversation, as Dean said, and it's a conversation in four parts. I'm going to give a little bit of background on the school discipline guidance that the Obama administration has recently put out. Then I'm going to talk about some of the policy problems with it, then the legal problems with it, and then finally have a discussion of what is to be done in light of these problems. At each step, though, after I talk, I'm going to stop talking and ask Hans to be sort of the color commentator on the sort of general narrative. Hans has done great work in this area and has, will no doubt revise and extend my remarks. So anyway, that's the basic roadmap to what we're going to be doing today. In terms of background, the Obama administration in January announced that it was going to be putting out this guidance in the area of school discipline. And in particular, this was a joint guidance that was put out by the Justice Department Civil Rights Division and the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights. And it was to guide school districts into making sure that their school discipline policies did not discriminate illegally, particularly in the area of race. That's the main focus, although the guidance makes clear that, of course, there's other kinds of discrimination, too. In one respect, this guidance was not new in what it said about the Obama administration's approach. The Obama administration had early on announced not only that it liked the disparate impact approach to civil rights laws generally, but also that it was going to use it in particular in the area of school discipline. And I suppose at this point I should just briefly define what the disparate impact approach is. The disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement says that a policy that is neutral in terms of its intent, neutral on its face, and neutral in its application, is nonetheless racially discriminatory, illegally racially discriminatory, if it has a racially disproportionate impact. So, for instance, the classic case of an employer who decides that he's going to hire only people with a high school diploma. He may adopt that with no racial motive. He may apply it with no racial motive. It's obviously a policy that on its face is racially neutral. But if it has a disproportionate racial effect, it is nonetheless illegal if you're taking the disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement. Likewise, in the school discipline area, approach would mean that a school discipline policy say that you're automatically suspended for 3 days if you are caught in a fight. If that policy has a disproportionate racial effect, it doesn't matter that it's applied equally to students of all racial and ethnic backgrounds, that it had no discriminatory intent, and that it's not discriminatory on its face. If it has a disproportionate racial impact, that is sufficient for there to be a prima facie case. As I said, the Obama administration has not made it a secret of the fact that it was going to take this approach. It announced that early on. It also has been very critical of what it calls the school-to-prison pipeline. That is, it believes that schools that are aggressively disciplining students, particularly if they call in the police, are not behaving in a right-minded manner, and that this is also something that they want to discourage. The guidance that was put out, of course, has things in it that oppose and caution against outright racial discrimination. But there's also a lot in it that uses the disparate impact approach, and that's what we're going to be focusing on here. I should say, though, that there's plenty of political correctness throughout the guidance. There's discussion of cultural awareness and implicit bias, and also the importance of data collection, which, of course, I'm afraid is going to be likely to drive school districts to make discipline decisions with an eye on race, particularly when that's coupled with the disparate impact approach. So that's kind of the general background of what the Obama administration has been up to in this area. And before I go into now some of the policy problems with the approach that's been taken, Hans, did you have anything that you wanted to add?
Yeah, I mean, they're not only are they pushing this disparate impact approach, but they're pushing a very crude, bottom-line-oriented disparate impact approach. So, in the workplace, if you were hiring people for a skilled position and blacks were most of the unskilled workforce, you wouldn't be liable for disparate impact just because there were, fewer blacks than whites hired. You'd have to look at the skilled applicants, I think. Whereas, if it's for a particular position that actually requires that skills. So the Supreme Court has been reluctant to rely on sort of crude racial quotas as the measure for disparate impact. But here, the Obama administration is relying on just that kind of crude bottom-line approach, because in its guidance it says, even if the only reason you're punishing more black students than whites for cell phone use during school is because more of them actually engage in cell phone use, or even if you're only punishing more minority students for tardiness because that's in fact who is really tardy, that doesn't matter. You still have engaged in disparate impact unless you show that there's no alternative discipline that would not have as much disparate impact, which is almost impossible to prove. So they've adopted a very, not just disparate impact theory, but a very crude, quota-like, bottom-line version of disparate impact theory for the schools that will be particularly troubling and difficult for school officials to deal with. In spite of the fact, right.
Well, so that's a really important point. And for those in the audience who are interested, if they go to the education department's website. They can look at this guidance, and it's the disparate impact approach that the Obama administration is going to be taking is outlined on pages 11 and 12, and it's just as bad as Hans says. In fact, it's even worse because Hans, I think in employment, for instance, a trivial disparate impact is not enough to trigger
right.
a prima facie case. You have to, there's a certain degree of statistical disparity that you have to show. It's called, a four-fifth rule.
Right.
That's not the approach, though, that the Obama administration takes here. By its terms, any disparate impact is enough to trigger an administration investigation. And as you indicated, the rebuttal is very tough. You have to show that it's necessary, that there's tightness of fit, that it furthers an important educational goal. These are all I'm quoting from the guidance itself. And then, as you pointed out, even if you've done all of that, all the education department has to come back with is a surrebuttal that says that, well, in our wisdom, we think that if you tweaked your discipline policy in this way, there would be less of a disparate impact, and so you are still violating the law.
And the reality is that they're always going to have these disparities because every school district in America has some degree of disparity, although the Obama administration in consent decrees has tried to force them closer to a quota for some of the school districts that it's entered into consent decrees with. It's something that reflects the larger society where crime rates are much higher among blacks than among whites, where, in the murder rate, blacks commit almost as many murders every year as whites, even though there are, six times as many non-Hispanic whites as there are blacks, or five times as many. So these are disparities that are going to be found in every school system in America, assuming it doesn't use racial quotas. And so effectively, they've deemed every large school system in America to be in violation of Title VI. And not only have they said that these disparities are indicative of disparate impact, which can only be rebutted by this difficult showing that no other discipline policy wouldn't have these disparities, but they've also suggested that it can also be considered indirect circumstantial proof of intentional discrimination for which there is no defense. There is no affirmative defense because the Obama administration refuses to accept the reality accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court in its Armstrong decision that rates of misconduct and crime rates differ among members of different racial groups. The Supreme Court expressly recognized in Armstrong that crime rates are different among different racial groups, and any criminologist would tell you that there are big disparities in, say, teen arrest rates, with black teenagers being arrested at much higher rates than white teenagers in America. For example, Heather McDonald has noted that black teenagers are 25 times as likely to get arrested in Chicago as whites, and the black homicide rate is for teenagers is 10 times higher nationally than for whites. Yet the Obama administration insists in its guidance that there's no proof that the disparities in discipline rates in school reflect anything other than discrimination by school officials. And it suggested not only that this is disparate impact, but that also, generally speaking, it's intentional discrimination as well.
That's right. And I should point out that the approach that the Obama administration has taken, taken to its logical conclusion, would insist not only on there being racial proportionality in who's disciplined, but also gender proportionality as well. That is, that girls not be disciplined at, or the boys not be disciplined at a higher rate than girls. That there be an assumption that boys are no more likely to get into trouble than girls, which is...
They'll never do that. That's the logical implication of what they're saying, but they will never insist on that, even though Title VI's sister statute, Title IX, is interpreted in pari materia with Title VI. So logically, you're right, Roger. That's exactly, if they were logical and consistent, that's exactly what they would say. But they will not say that because this is not about law. This is about politics. And, of course, their demand for what are essentially crude racial quotas in school discipline is something that will create constitutional conflicts as well, because the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a racial proportionality rule for school discipline in People Who Care versus Rockford Board of Education, where they said that requiring that no more black students be referred for discipline than whites was a racial quota in essence, in substance, that violated the 14th Amendment. So what the Obama administration is doing is it's telling the nation's school districts, you need to effectively violate the 14th Amendment if you want your federal funding to continue and not be cut off under Title VI. And since the nation's schools would much rather keep their federal funds than run a small risk that they'll be sued for reverse discrimination by some white student, I think, you know, an awful lot of them will adopt what are veiled or de facto racial quotas, even if it's unconstitutional, because they want that federal funds to continue.
Well, let's back up for a minute now and talk some more about some of the policy problems with this approach, and then we'll move on and talk more specifically about some of the legal problems. I mean, obviously, there are federalism problems with the federal government micromanaging what schools do, particularly if they don't really have any reason to believe that there's actual racial discrimination going on. I should say that conservatives acknowledge that zero tolerance policies can often be taken to ridiculous extremes. In fact, I think it's frequently conservatives who are leading the charge in pointing out that discipline, having a no gun policy that covers a toy gun or a pastry eaten into the shape of a gun, saying that has to result in a suspension is ridiculous. The problem, though, is that you really don't add anything to anything useful to the discussion by insisting that these policies be evaluated through a racial lens. And in fact, what you're going to end up doing if you discourage schools from disciplining students who actually are discipline problems, which inevitably you're going to do if you threaten them with losing their federal money if their numbers don't come out right, you're going to have more unruly classrooms in schools that are heavily minority. And, of course, the students who are most going to lose out are themselves going to be African-American and Latino students.
That's what a University of Rochester professor found. You're exactly right. That's exactly what I believe it was Joshua Kinzer of the University of Rochester, in fact, found, that when you get rid of discipline that's needed to maintain order in the classrooms, it increases the minority achievement gap and backfires against black students. And another finding, which is very interesting, is that, as Andrew Coulson of the Cato Institute has noted, these idiotic, draconian, zero-tolerance policies were in many cases adopted by school districts that were fearing disparate impact charges in the past. So this very disparate impact notion of discrimination helped fuel and create these rigid zero tolerance policies under which kids get kicked out of school for having a toy gun.
Well, and isn't I mentioned earlier the administration's objection to what it calls the school to prison pipeline, where they don't like the fact that the police are frequently called to schools, in the administration's opinion, too quickly. But isn't that also an unintended consequence of liberal policies in the past?
Yes, and you have to bring the police in. If you don't have the ability to run yourself, one incentive is that you summon the police to handle what was previously handled in-house. And it's an enormous problem, and these disparate impact in the past, the Carter administration also liked disparate impact, although it was nowhere near as avid as the Obama administration. In past administrations, when they pushed this, that was one of the reasons that schools adopted these disparate impact policies, so they could say, look, we're applying our rigid rule to everybody exactly the same, and by sweeping in lots of minor offenders, most of whom were white, they were able to reduce their racial disparities. The sick reality is draconian zero-tolerance policies have less relative racial disparities than the more nuanced policies that only punish serious offenders. There's no racial disparity in who commits jaywalking. There is a huge racial disparity in the murder rate. The murder rate is five times as high among blacks as it is among non-Hispanic whites. So these zero-tolerance policies, by sweeping everybody in, by, you know, expanding the dragnet to cover more people, actually reduce racial disparities, and that's why they were adopted in part. It's because of this fear of being accused of discrimination on the part of school officials. They want to show they treat everybody exactly the same, no matter how mindlessly and rigidly, and that's why they adopted the very policies that now, ironically, are being criticized by people like Eric Holder, whose ideological brethren are the whole reason why these policies were adopted in the first place.
Well, before we move on to the discussion of the legal problems with this approach, and then with what might be done about it, I'm always reluctant to leave any kind of a policy discussion in this area without pointing out what the underlying reason for these racial disparities is, and that is the fact that there are huge racial disparities in the out-of-wedlock birth rates among, you know, different groups. More than 7 out of 10 African Americans now are born out of wedlock, more than 6 out of 10 Native Americans, more than 5 out of 10 Latinos, versus fewer than 3 out of 10 non-Hispanic whites and fewer than 2 out of 10 Asian Americans. And, you know, those disparities are dramatic, and they line up very well with how successful different groups are and how much different groups are struggling, not only in terms of school discipline, but also in terms of poverty and college admission scores and, you know, crime, all of these things fit in with growing up in a home without a father, particularly for boys. So anyway, I wanted to, you know, to get in that point. Well, in terms of the legal objections, Hans, the problem, of course, with the whole disparate impact approach is that it pushes people to make decisions based on race. I mean, it's very ironic that the idea is to diminish the amount of racial discrimination, yet this approach is one that encourages people to make decisions with an eye based on race. It actually makes it irrelevant. As I think was implicit in our discussion before, even if a school district comes in and proves that it had no racial intent, that it is absolutely unbiased in the way that it comes up with these rules and applies them, none of those things matter. And so you have a policy that's pushing schools to make decisions with the basis on the basis of race, and that itself raises constitutional problems, doesn't it?
Yeah, and they're not supposed to interpret a statute like Title VI in a way that has race-conscious provisions unless it's absolutely necessary to do so. Like the Supreme Court ruled in Alexander versus Sandoval that the Title VI statute doesn't even reach disparate impact by itself. It left open, theoretically, whether an agency could enforce regulations that involve disparate impact. But the Education Department's guidance doesn't even cite any particular disparate impact regulations. It's essentially like some, you know, informal pronouncement designed to avoid notice and comment, because it's basically telling you you can't do this because it violates Title VI through disparate impact. And the Supreme Court said in Alexander versus Sandoval back in 2001, Title VI doesn't reach disparate impact. We will leave for another day whether an agency regulation trying to expand Title VI administratively to disparate impact is even valid. We won't let you sue over it. Title VI doesn't reach disparate impact. And here you have this guidance saying we're going to hold you liable under this race-conscious disparate impact theory, and they don't even cite a particular regulation. I mean, how do you square that with the fact that local governments under federalism have to be given a plain, you know, explicit warning that they're liable for a federal legal mandate before they can be held liable under it? How do you square that with the fact that the Supreme Court has said over and over again in the voting rights context that we will not interpret a statute as being race-conscious beyond the absolute minimum because that raises constitutional problems? Remember, unlike workplace laws, which have a disparate impact component written into the statute itself, Title VI itself only prohibits intentional discrimination. And the
When the court in Alexander versus Sandoval, you know, pointed that out, and reserved the question of whether these regulations might themselves be ultra vires, it did so in a way that suggested that there is a problem here.
Yes.
You know, the wording in the footnote says that you know we can't help but observe that it is odd for a regulation to make something illegal that the underlying statute permits. And, of course, that's precisely what's going on here.
Worse, here they're effectively declaring that what was illegal under the statute, which is intentional racial discrimination, including racial quotas, is effectively required by this their broad notion of disparate impact. They're not just declaring something that was previously legal illegal. They're declaring something that was previously illegal, racial quotas, to almost be legal by pressuring schools to adopt them. You know, usually, if you have a statute that bans disparate impact, the courts have to work with that statute, however thorny and troublesome the issues it raises. But here the statute itself doesn't do it, just this administrative guidance that at best is a regulation. And a regulation can't override the statute that it's issued under. The statute controls, not the regulation. The statute is supreme. And here they're effectively using this informal guidance under Title VI to try and nullify Title VI's prohibitions against intentional racial discrimination, including racial quotas, which the Supreme Court struck down under Title VI in the Bakke and Gratz cases. So they're trying to use informal guidance imposed without notice and comment under Title VI to nullify the protections that the Title VI statute itself gives to victims of reverse discrimination.
Well, this is, a good segue into the last part of our discussion, which is what is to be done, what kinds of lawsuits or other pushback might be possible. As an introduction to that, I want to point out that the political correctness that underlies this approach, that, you know, there's something wrong if you don't get your numbers right, and therefore the numbers must be gotten right at all costs, is something that has a lot of currency in academia and in the administration, but I think that in not only among conservatives, but in the popular culture generally, people are losing patience with it. And on National Review Online today, there was an interesting clip here, and this is an interview with Jerry Seinfeld, which I'm going to play in a second. I hope this works. But in the interview, he is responding to criticism that he got because of a lack of diversity on his show, which is Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. So with that introduction, let me try to play this.
Now
there were a lot of things about Comedians in Cars in the beginning. The first 10 I did, I think, were all white males. And people were writing all about that, which
that's part of the reason why I asked. People had tweeted at me when I said I'm interviewing with Jerry Seinfeld. Oh, okay, ask him about their gender diversity on the show.
Yeah, I mean, people think it's the census or something. I mean, this has got to represent the actual pie chart of America. Who cares? It's just funny, you know. Funny is the world that I live in. You're funny, I'm interested. You're not funny, I'm not interested.
Okay.
And I have no interest in gender or race or anything like that, but everyone else is kind of with their little calculating, is this the exact right mix? You know, I think that's, to me, it's anti-comedy. It's
okay.
Anti-comedy. It's more about, you know, PC nonsense than are you making us laugh or not?
Right.
Okay. Well, Hans, what kind of legal challenges do you think might be conceivably brought against this, or other kinds of challenges?
Well, for a white student or Asian student, because, you know, really, Asians have the lowest infraction rate, so the irony is if you're going to do racial quotas, they'll suffer the most. But a white or Asian student who's subjected to more severe discipline to meet some school racial quota that requires more whites to be disciplined versus blacks, they would have standing, and they would have a cause of action under the Seventh Circuit's 1997 decision in People Who Care versus Rockford Board of Education, where Chief Judge Posner, for a unanimous Seventh Circuit, declared that it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to have a racial balance rule and for school suspensions, and that it violated the Constitution by virtue of being a de facto racial quota to require that no more blacks be referred for discipline than whites relative to their percentage of the student body. So a white student subjected to more serious discipline than a similarly situated black student could sue under the Constitution and under the Title VI statute itself. And occasionally students have recovered large amounts of damages under Title VI, like a Hispanic student who was racially harassed out of school. He got $1 million because it reduced the value of his lifetime earnings by virtue of being driven out of school. You could also theoretically have a school district oppose the education department, but in the real world, very few of them will ever do that because they don't want to risk losing their federal funds. But if you had a wealthy school district that had a relatively small fraction of its budget coming from federal funds, threatened with the funds cut off by the education department, in a state with a conservative AG, maybe Texas or something, maybe that school district would have the gumption when threatened with a cutoff of federal funds by the Obama Education Department for not having a de facto racial quota in school discipline. Maybe that school district would have the gumption to fight it in court and challenge the Obama administration's interpretation of Title VI as being unconstitutional, as being contrary to the Title VI statute itself, as being promulgated, this informal guidance without notice and comment, and not seemingly interpreting any regulation where it might get some deference, putting aside the race consciousness and the constitutional issues. So I can see either an affected student who's subjected to more serious discipline suing over this, or a school district. And the other possible category of plaintiff would be a student who is, you know, beaten up or something, and then their assailant is given very little discipline because they're of a favored race that has, you know, that is a beneficiary of the racial quota and discipline. And such a student might theoretically bring a racially hostile education environment claim under the logic of the Supreme Court's Davis decision, but that's a very demanding standard to meet. You know, you need to show an extremely hostile environment, more hostile typically than you need to show in a workplace, to sue over that. So the most likely school teachers, I think, could have standing to sue if it directly impacted them. I think the rules of standing are fairly broad under civil rights laws, although Title VI isn't as broad as the Fair Housing Act in terms of standing. I'm trying to think of the Constitution, whether they would have third-party standing under the Constitution. I guess they would if it tangibly impacted their work environment. You could theoretically have a teacher. And, of course, if a teacher was threatened, you know, there are teachers who've been, in Baltimore, there are teachers who've been roughed up and then their assailants have been given very little punishment because the school system now wants to reduce the number of suspensions of minority students to curry favor with, you know, the liberal interest groups who love these new Obama administration guidelines. And if you're one of those teachers who's been roughed up and is now afraid to go back into the classroom, you might have standing to raise it as well.
You mentioned groups. Short of a lawsuit, I'm wondering if there are some, you know, organizations that might be willing to go to the administration and complain. For instance, the National Association of School Boards, teachers unions may be a lawsuit.
Right. Most of the school associations are really politically correct and won't do anything. The National School Board Association, even though it's somewhat liberal, will actually occasionally stand up to, you know, the administration and complained about their overly broad bullying guidance that defined all kinds of bullying that was not really discriminatory as a civil rights violation a couple of years ago. It filed an amicus brief in the Lopez case where the Supreme Court declared that, you know, guns near schools was not within Congress's commerce power to regulate. So the National School Boards Association might be of some help. But again, they have political constraints that an individual plaintiff would not. The problem is finding those individual students who are harmed and would have standing to sue, because they'll predominantly be working class students going to relatively poor schools that have relatively high violence rates. And they are probably not going to know how to reach a nonprofit that might represent them pro bono in a challenge to these school discipline guidelines.
It's very unfortunate. Dean, if you want to start fielding questions from the audience, that would be great. it is a real tragedy that the administration is taking this approach. And as I indicated at the outset, it's a problem not only with respect to school discipline, but it's an approach that the administration has taken across the board with employment, housing, lending, voting, even environmental regulations, all are being written and enforced with an eye on race and ethnicity, which, of course, turns the ideals of the civil rights movement on its head.
Well, let's do open it up for questions. If you, we'll all in a moment hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me say that we're looking for somebody with an opposing view to have on our call today, and obviously we didn't get one. So let me I'll begin while we're seeing who's going to weigh in here with a question, maybe by making a question from the devil's advocate position. I think the views, Roger and Hans, your views sort of presuppose that everybody in any powerful position in this country with decision-making authority, they've got to be assumed to be acting neutrally and without discriminatory intent. I think the cat is sort of out of the bag in this country that we're not allowed to discriminate, certainly not intentionally. And I think anybody who really wants to discriminate can think of some sort of racially neutral test, facially neutral test, and put it in place, and then it's left up to the victims of this sort of unintentional discrimination to prove intent. And why should that be the case? Why should it be incumbent on the victims of discrimination to prove intent when, after all, why should that be their burden when they're lined up against the powerful state actors or government actors who control all the information that you need to show intent? And who have, relatively speaking, much greater resources to try a case to defend themselves.
Well, I mean, empirically, I think the idea that you have these decision makers who have veiled racial animus towards minorities in discipline is hard to square with the fact that the category of students who have the lowest discipline rate is not whites but Asians. I mean, if this is a function of white racism, why is the discipline rate for Asian students, particularly East Asian students, even lower than for whites? Well, the honest answer is it's because they're less likely to commit infractions, and the school officials who are fair recognize that and don't discipline them. You know, there's this reverence for learning among Chinese Americans that's reflected in a lower discipline rate. You have a slightly lower rate of out-of-wedlock births. So if this were an artifact of racism, you would see the discipline rate would be lower for whites than for all other groups, but it's not. It's higher than for Asians. And to me, that shows that what's going on is not some type of veiled discrimination, but by and large, not discrimination at all, but rather neutral discipline policies being applied for pressing needs of safety and school order, and the resulting disparities being a function of disparities in who actually commits these offenses. And I'd also point out that even to show intentional discrimination, you don't need to show some smoking gun. You can show it through circumstantial evidence. I would not have a problem with the government using regression analysis if it were truly first-rate regression analysis that took into account all variables, that there was intentional discrimination going on in the school system. The way if an employer in a town who was hiring people for unskilled positions where half of all applicants were black hired 1,000 people and never hired a single black person, we would say that was circumstantial statistical proof of intentional discrimination, not just disparate impact. I wouldn't have a problem with that. The problem here is that the Obama administration has basically thumbed its nose at statistical reality, insisted that these disparities are basically conclusive proof of discrimination. It's ignored the fact that you're not supposed to compare apples with oranges in your statistical comparisons. So that's really my problem. My problem is not that statistics don't tell you anything. I think they can tell you a lot when you use them correctly.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, in fact, it's not hard to show intentional discrimination. You know, you can still use statistical evidence and other circumstantial evidence to prove disparate treatment. The Justice Department, you know, brings and wins disparate treatment cases every day. It's you know, this notion that it's you have to have a smoking gun and that smoking guns are unavailable is just not true. It's also not true that there's this asymmetry in the two parties here. You know, the civil rights groups have at least as much money as, you know, your average, you know, school district. And of course, on top of that, you also have the federal government itself, which has infinitely, you know, deep pockets.
And you have asymmetric attorney's fees too, because if you bring a discrimination lawsuit and you win, they have to pay your attorney's fees. But if you lose, you don't have to pay the school district's attorney's fees. So in a sense, there's that already gives the plaintiffs or the complainant a leg up in some cases.
That's true as well. And then finally, you know, as Justice Scalia pointed out in his concurring opinion in Ritchie versus DeStefano, if the idea behind the disparate impact approach is to smoke out intentional discrimination, you should still allow defendants at least an affirmative defense that if they can prove themselves that they were not acting with discriminatory intent, they should be able to win. That defense is not available under the disparate impact approach. So, Dean, that was a really stupid question, and don't ask any more questions like that, please.
Thank you, Roger. I appreciate that. Let's turn to our audience now, see if we can get some intelligent questions. We've got a couple callers with questions. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
This is David Applegate, a private practitioner in Chicago, and I'm not sure if I can raise the bar a whole lot over that, but I have first a hypothetical question. Let's suppose my great-grandmother was black and she married a Native American and that everybody else down the line was white. How much can my kids get away with in school?
Well, yeah, that is the
ask Elizabeth Warren.
I'm sorry?
Ask Elizabeth Warren. She was 132nd American, right? She qualified, at least for her early hires.
Well, this is another problem with the whole disparate impact approach is that, you know, you once you get away from the ultimate question being whether there is, in fact, racial intent, you get into these problems of, well, how do you measure disparate impact? You know, is what's relevant? You know, how finely are you going to divide the different racial and ethnic groups? You know, what suppose that there's a disparate impact among Asians generally, but not among particular kinds of Asians? Or as you say, how do we define who is a member of which group? You know, what if a policy has a disparate impact on non-Hispanic blacks, but not non-Hispanic whites? I mean, there are all kinds of problems, and I think your question helps illustrate the kinds of problems that you get into once you move away from asking the question, is this policy actually treating people differently because of race and ethnicity?
So let me ask a final question at another end of the scale. We talked a lot about policy, about statutes, trumping regulations, and so forth, not a lot about the Constitution. What is the constitutional source of this policy? Because I cannot find it anywhere in Article 1, Section 8, or anywhere in Article 2, dealing with the whole executive branch. Does this spring from privileges and immunities or equal protection under the 14th Amendment? Is that the theory?
Well, it really springs from the spending clause power that Congress has, which is a reason to interpret the Education Department's power narrowly, because as Roger has noted before, you know, there's this plain statement rule that limits the ability of the federal government to create liabilities, or where unless it has very clearly done so, rather than some nebulous disparate impact guidance, because spending clause statutes, as the Supreme Court has noted in its decisions in Gebzer and Davis and other cases, have to be interpreted narrowly. And since it is based on the spending clause, since Title VI is a spending clause statute, the Education Department and Justice Department should not be allowed to stretch it like Turkish taffy to ban all these things that a plain reading of the statute wouldn't permit. Now, the administration also argues that Congress relied on the 14th Amendment to abrogate state sovereign immunity under Title VI and Title IX, and courts have generally accepted, or many appeals courts have accepted that. I don't know if the Fifth Circuit has. There may be some limits to that. So generally, the spending clause is the source of Congress's power to apply Title VI and Title IX, which logically means they should be interpreted not as broadly as you might interpret some other statute, but they also rely on the enforcement clause of the 14th Amendment to abrogate state sovereign immunity.
And I would add that not only is there the constitutional problem of Congress not having a very convincing case that it has a font of authority to by which to pass this, by which to take this approach, but there are affirmative constitutional problems with it doing so, beyond the fact that it just doesn't have the authority. And we've already, you know, talked about the fact that, and Justice Scalia, you know, pointed out that passing a civil rights law, or what is ostensibly a civil rights law, that actually encourages people to discriminate based on race and ethnicity raises its own constitutional problems. And in addition, there are federalism problems when the federal government starts intervening into areas that are traditionally ones left to the states.
Right. And in Miller versus Johnson, I think the Supreme Court said that we will not defer to Justice Department interpretations of a civil rights statute when they're race conscious, because by definition that raises potential constitutional problems. And under the canon of constitutional doubts, also known as the constitutional avoidance principle, you're not supposed to defer to an agency's interpretation of a statute, even when you otherwise would defer to it under so-called Chevron deference. So even if you would ordinarily defer to the agency here you should do just the opposite because of the race-conscious nature of its guidance. And that's even assuming that this guidance can be dignified by treating it as a regulation, when it seems to interpret no regulations and merely be this radical gloss on the statute itself, which the Supreme Court has said does not reach disparate impact in its Alexander versus Sandoval decision.
Does that raise an additional way in which the what the Education Department has done here might be challenged?
I don't think that there's some general catch-all disparate impact regulation that covers everything. I think under Title VI, which deals with race, there are a lot of disparate impact regulations, but they still don't cover everything that the statute might reach. And under Title IX, there's virtually no disparate impact regulations. So even if they had the power to adopt a regulation about disparate impact under Title VI, if they haven't done so, or if they're not purporting to interpret that regulation, then I think they get no deference. And in fact, if they're imposing some new obligation they haven't discussed before, then they may have violated the Administrative Procedure Act by doing this without notice and comment. Because if you read this guidance that they have, not only is it a radical expansion of, you know, what any school district would expect in terms of its liability by reading the Title VI statute, but it doesn't cite to any regulation as far as I can tell. And there are some existing Title VI disparate impact regulations, which, as you've noted, are of dubious validity under that language in Alexander versus Sandoval. But they don't even, I believe, cite to them or purport to rely specifically on those. So it may violate the Administrative Procedure Act. It may violate the canon of constitutional doubts, even if the court doesn't directly reach the constitutional question. It may violate the plain statement rule in terms of being beyond their power under the spending clause, in addition to the fact that it can violate the 14th Amendment rights of individual students under the logic of the Seventh Circuit's decision in People Who Care versus Rockford Board of Education. So there are a whole host of ways that this could theoretically be challenged legally, although the sad truth is, in the real world, school districts, which don't want to lose their federal funds, none of them is going to want to be the first to raise these issues.
Once again, we're talking to Hans Bader and Roger Clegg. If you have a question, push the star button
and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller in the queue, and then our lines are wide open. Before we go to our next caller, let me make a quick announcement that later this week on Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, in what is now our next scheduled telephone conference call, we'll be discussing the new book by Tim Sandifer, The Conscience of the Constitution. That is Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Let's now go to our next caller.
Hello?
Hi, this is
Alice. We can hear you.
This is Allison Stillman. I'm with the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. I wanted to ask, this is a subject in which the administration has clearly spoken a lot before. They've been leading up to this for some time, and the commission for which I work even did a lengthy report on this, issued about a year before the guidance came out. So I wanted to ask, is there anything in this long document that surprised you, and would you consider this to be a better or worse document than you might have expected?
I mean, I found it to be worse because I was hoping that their disparate impact notion would be something other than sort of the crude bottom line version of disparate impact law that was questioned by the Supreme Court in its Ward's Cove versus Antonio decision. I mean, I'm not sure how you would apply that here anyway. But, you know, in the workplace, the Supreme Court eventually decided that disparate impact was kind of designed to be used to look at components of the hiring process to sort of smoke out the ones that were invalid. But rather than just looking at the overall bottom line of the entire employer's workforce for a racial quota. And I'm not sure how you would apply that principle here, but if ever you would apply it, you would think it would at least raise eyebrows that they're just looking at this, they're finding disparate impact not based on some aspect of the way the students are treated, even in a neutral way, once they're accused of an offense, but rather they're applying it to the crude bottom line result of just you disciplined twice as many blacks because twice as many blacks were guilty, which is, you know, a very crude racial quota-like version of disparate impact law that the Supreme Court became uneasy with in the Ward's Cove and Watson decisions. And I'm not sure which side of the line you put this on, whether the courts would view this as being sort of like the thing that they said you couldn't do in Ward's Cove, or whether it's more like typical disparate impact because it applies only to certain students who are already, you know, accused in some cases. I'm not making a lot. It's hard to articulate what I mean, but I guess what disturbed me was that the very notion of disparate impact they have is this crude bottom line variant of it that seems to me like it would trouble the Supreme Court for the same reason that the very crude bottom line version in the Ward's Cove case troubled the Supreme Court.
Yeah, Allison, I have very, you know, low expectations of this administration, but I would say that it's hard for me to imagine how this could have been very much worse. The one thing that was, I guess, a relief is that it wasn't any longer, so that I didn't have to, you know, spend a lot of time reading through it. And I think, though, that that in itself is you know, shows that it was rather, you know, conclusory in the approach that it took. But it's you know, pretty bad.
I mean, in their past guidance, you know, they, for whatever else you couldn't say about them, they did not use the business necessity language. If you look at their past, the Office for Civil Rights, where I used to work in the education department. When I worked there, they were always very clear that schools got some deference, even under their disparate impact guidance that they had. Like, in whether a course, whether an academic requirement or a high-stakes test excluded more blacks than whites because more of them failed it. They did not apply the very stringent business necessity test that applies in the workplace under the 91 Civil Rights Act, because the 1991 Civil Rights Act only changed the law as to workplaces, not education, thus leaving intact the greater degree of deference that institutions got under the Supreme Court's Ward's Cove versus Antonio decision in 1988 or 89. So when I worked at the Education Department, the test was, even if it has a disparate impact, it's still okay if the school shows that that policy furthered a legitimate educational interest. Not a educational necessity or business necessity, but just a legitimate educational interest. And then it was pretty clear that if they showed that, then the Education Department could only find them liable if it could show that that policy was had a lot more, you know, disparate impact than some other policy that would achieve their goal just as well. And if you read this guidance, they sometimes use the legitimate educational goal language, but other times they speak of important educational, which sounds like a higher standard. And they also make it unclear even whether, you know, that there really is any, that it's even unclear whether the school bears the burden in places of showing that another policy wouldn't have had the same disparate impact. So in subtle ways, the test is stated worse in this guidance. And also, in past, when I worked for the education department, I never came into contact with guidance that applied it like this to student discipline. So I had hopes that maybe they wouldn't apply a sort of crude bottom line approach to student discipline. But, you know, if, to the extent that they've deviated from past policy, that itself might violate the Administrative Procedure Act, because under the under D.C. Circuit precedent, under something called the Paralyzed Veteran Rule, when an agency changes even an interpretive rule that institutions have come to rely on, it may need to open it up to notice and comment before doing so. So to the extent that this may deviate from past Education Department guidance regarding what is needed to show disparate impact in violation of Title VI, even putting aside the fact that this wasn't, that this is effectively imposing new obligations without notice and comment, it may violate the Paralyzed Veteran Rule and require notice and comment, even if it would otherwise only be considered an interpretive rule that doesn't require such notice and comment. And I bet what I just said is utterly confusing, so I apologize for not being able to encapsulate it better than that. But yes, I do think that it does materially worsen the way they conceptualize disparate impact.
Allison, you alluded to the work that the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights has done in this area, and that would be a good source, I think, for people in the audience to consult. John Martin has written a good piece on school discipline, as I recall, that was published in Engage, you know, the Federalist Society publication, and the Commission report, I think, included some good material, didn't it, from Gail Harriet and others? Allison,
I think
there?
Yes.
Oh, was she been? Is that correct?
No, Allison. Allison's still on.
Yes, it did have material by various commissioners, including Gail Harriet.
Any other questions, Dean?
No, we don't have any questions. We have a couple minutes left if each of you just want to express a final thought.
Well, I think the only thing that I would remind people of is that this whole disparate impact approach, we've talked about it in the school discipline context, but you know, we see it in the housing context, which is a couple of cases the Supreme Court has almost been able to decide, but these cases have settled at the last minute. There's, I think, another opportunity in another lawsuit for this issue to get resolved in that context. But the new legislation that has been proposed to amend the Voting Rights Act is an attempt to ensure that an aggressive disparate impact approach is taken in the voting area. This is one of the many reasons why this legislation is bad. There was a good editorial on it in the Wall Street Journal today. The EEOC has been abusing this approach during this administration, trying to discourage employers from using criminal background checks. And that policy, by the way, has been challenged by the Attorney General of Texas. I think that Hans mentioned him you know, earlier on. The administration is using this in the this approach in the lending area. They've used it you know, even in the environmental area, where you know, if you pollute in a way that kills everyone, so that there's no disparate impact, that's okay. But if it if the sicknesses skew along racial lines, well, then there's a problem. And then finally, the approach is used to challenge people who don't translate their services into foreign languages on the theory that, well, if you're providing something only in English, then this might have a disparate impact on the basis of national origin in some way. It's a very bad approach. It has all kinds of bad policy and legal outcomes, and it needs to be aggressively challenged.
Huh? And there's danger. There's the danger that even though they don't have the statutory authority to do this now, really, that they may acquire it. For example, one of the past defense authorization bills in the Senate, Senator Brown, with the assistance of some other Democratic senators, tried to add a obscure rider to the defense bill to expand Title VI and Title IX to uncover disparate impact claims, which would essentially overturn the Supreme Court's Alexander versus Sandoval decision. And it was added in committee, and nobody even noticed it in the Veterans Affairs Committee. They added it to a veterans bill. And then that whole bill was about to be added to the defense authorization, and people were almost unaware of it until it was discovered at the last minute. And Senator Cornyn of Texas, to his credit, objected to it being added, so it was not added to the defense authorization. But otherwise, this whole disparate impact notion might have been formally engrafted into Title VI, and one of the principal legal ways of challenging this would have disappeared, because there would still be the constitutional argument that racial quotas in student discipline violate court rulings like People Who Care versus Rockford Board of Education, but the statutory leg would be much weakened. So I think if in future liberal Congresses you'll see additional attempts to radically expand the reach of Title VI to ban disparate impact, in addition to radically ratcheting up the damages that they may have to pay out in certain types of discrimination claims by minority students. And the net result may be to worsen the legal climate. And in the meantime, it's going to be hard to find individual affected students who are mostly powerless, who are actually harmed by these rules, because most of these racial quotas will fly below the radar screen. I mean, there are occasional cases where an educator will come out and admit that they discipline based on quota, like Edmund Janko admitting in Manhattan Institute City Journal that he punished white students with suspension for things that only led to a verbal warning for a black student to comply with a racial quota after there was a civil rights inquiry in his school. But it's very rare that people will publicly admit that. So it's going to be hard to find the victims of these quotas and bring a lawsuit in short order. It's going to take quite a while to find someone who's going to be able to be in a position to bring a lawsuit challenging the Obama administration's pressure on schools to adopt racial quotas in school discipline.
Well, we're going to have to let that be our final word today. My thanks go out to Hans Bader and Roger Clegg. We certainly appreciate your presentations today and a guest appearance by Jerry Seinfeld, of course. And to our audience, I encourage you to join us for our next scheduled Teleform conference call Thursday at 1 p.m. When we're talking about the book, The Conscience of the Constitution. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.